Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am in Numbers, chapter 16. I'm going to do the first half of the book, verses 1 through 24. The whole chapter deals with Korah's rebellion. I'm going to divide it into two parts, part 1 and part 2. Our context is this. In our last chapter, we looked at various laws about sacrifices and covering unintentional sins. Then we looked at a Sabbath breaker being executed, and then we saw tassels being appointed for the sons of Israel to remind them of the holiness of the law. And so now we go to number 16, Korah's rebellion, verses 1 through 3. Now Korah, the son of Izhar, the son of Kohath, the son of Levi, with Dathan and Abiram, the sons of Eliab, and On, the son of Peleth, sons of Reuben, took action, and they rose up before Moses, together with some of the sons of Israel, 250 leaders of the congregation, chosen in the assembly, men of renown. They assembled together against Moses and Aaron, and said to them, "You have gone far enough, for all the congregation are holy, every one of them, and the Lord is in their midst. So why do you exalt yourselves above the assembly of the Lord?" Now verse 1 says, "Now." Well, I'm assuming it's in chronological order, coming right after the law about the tassels on the garments and the execution of the Sabbath breaker. Some people don't see it that way and take it out of chronological order. Doesn't really matter. Now, Korah is the instigator of this rebellion. He's a great-grandson of Levi, so he's a Levite. He's a cousin to Moses and Aaron because he's in the same family of Kohath, that tribe of the Levites that was responsible for carrying the holy furniture, the sacred furniture of the tabernacle as they moved through the wilderness. So Kohath is a Levite. We'll see in verse 10, he's a Levite wanting to be a priest. Carrying the tabernacle furniture was too lowly for him. This rebellion is pretty famous. It's mentioned in the New Testament. Jude 1 verse 11, "Woe to them," talking about the bad guy, the heretics in the New Testament, in Jude's time. "Woe to them, for they have gone the way of Cain, and for pay they have rushed headlong into the error of Balaam, and perished in the rebellion of Korah." So this is a significant event in Old Testament history. Korah is mentioned first because he's the ringleader of the rebellion. He's a cousin to Moses and Aaron. Moses and Aaron were of the family of Kohath of the tribe of Levi too. So there were some family connections in this rebellion also. Pretty serious business. Now Korah is the son of Izhar. Who is Izhar? Well, he's the brother of Amram, who is the father of Moses. So that makes Korah the first cousin of Moses. We see that Izhar is the brother of Amram in Exodus 6:18. The sons of Kohath, Amram and Izhar. Now one other person, some other persons mentioned besides Korah, is Dathan and Abiram, the sons of Eliab. No, I don't know who Eliab is. I don't know if anybody does. But they were Reubenites, and On is a Reubenite too. And no mention of him is made elsewhere in the scriptures. And in fact, this is the last we hear of him. And so many think because of that, that he separated himself from the rebellion after Moses tried to stop the rebellion and said, "Hey, stop it, guys." Now, why might these three sons of Reuben be involved in a rebellion? We've already seen that Korah was involved in the rebellion because he wanted to be a priest. I didn't read that verse. Let me read that verse to you to prove that. Number 16:10. "He, that's God, has brought you near, Korah, and all your fellow Levites who are with you, but you are seeking the priesthood as well." Remember, Levites can't be priests. You have to be in the family, in Aaron's family, to be a priest, and the Levites, an Aaronite was a Levite, but a Levite was not an Aaronite, because Aaron was a subset of family of Levi. So there were a lot of Levites that weren't eligible for the priesthood because they weren't in the family of Aaron. But Kohath wasn't satisfied with that. He wanted to be a priest as well. Now, as far as the Reubenites, Dathan, Abiram, and On, why would they might possibly be involved in a rebellion? Well, Reuben was the firstborn, but he had the right of the firstborn taken away from him. Why? Because Reuben had defiled his father's bed by being intimate with Bilhah, his father's concubine. This, of course, was hundreds of years before this in the life of the patriarchs. The scriptures that tell us this is Genesis 35:22. "While Israel was living in that region, Reuben went in and slept with his father's concubine, Bilhah." Well, that's serious business, folks. Sleeping with your father's wife? Yuck. It's also recorded in 1 Chronicles 5:1 and 2. These were the sons of Reuben, the firstborn of Israel. He was the firstborn, but his birthright was given to the sons of Joseph, that's Ephraim and Manasseh, because Reuben defiled his father's bed. He is not listed in the genealogy according to birthright. Although Judah became strong among his brothers and a ruler came from him, that's David, I suppose, the birthright was given to Joseph. So you see, this was a big deal, the losing of the birthright. Reuben was stigmatized. The family of Reuben was stigmatized from evermore, which shows your sins have consequences that live on after you, ladies and gentlemen. Good application point there. Now, to show the lack of honor that Reuben had managed to win for itself, if you look at the order of march that we saw in Numbers chapter 2, we see that the ark is at the very front of the column, but Judah is right behind, leading the first three tribes in the order of march. Judah, Issachar, and Zebulun. So Judah has the preeminence now. Then came the tabernacle, and then Reuben was behind the tabernacle. So it was permanently, Reuben was permanently marked out as having been dishonored and deprived of its birthright. Another interesting thing is how the camp was laid out. It facilitated the rebellion. This is not the order of march now, but when they were camped and stationary, the tabernacle was in the center, and Kohath, the members of Kohath, where Korah was right south of the tabernacle, right up next against it, protecting it. And then if you look to the immediate southeast of the tabernacle, you see the tribe of Reuben. In other words, they are catty-cornered to each other, but in contact, so they could easily arrange this conspiracy because they were close together. So now Korah and the Reubenites rise up in rebellion, and this is just another rebellion that's going on at this time when times got tough. After those spies came back with a bad report in chapter 12, Moses had to endure a rebellion by Miriam and Aaron. That was before the spies, but that was a rebellion. And then, of course, you remember God gave Miriam a temporary skin disease because of that. Well, that example of what happens to people that rebel against Moses didn't seem to impress Korah and his friends too much. How about even earlier when Nadab and Abihu offered strange fire after the establishment of the tabernacle? They were toasted. They were roasted. Did that affect Korah? Nah, they're going to rebel anyway. As Adam Clark says, only the most quote-unquote brutish of men could have forgotten. Well, so these brutes nevertheless will raise up a rebellion. Now, what's the object lesson in this? Godly leadership is really a thankless task, folks. I'll never forget a friend of mine said, oh, I wish I could be a leader. And I'm thinking, are you crazy? You got to be called to be a leader because it's not fun. It's not fun at all. I'm not leading anybody right now. And I'll tell you, the amount of pressure that is off me is unbelievable. Unbelievable when you don't have to be a leader. Well, Moses had a lot of pressure on him. Notice now that besides the three Reubenites, Dathan, Abiram, and On, and Korah, the Kohathite, you also have 250 leaders of the congregation that rose up along with those aforesaid gentlemen in order to facilitate this rebellion. Now, who are these leaders? John Gill says they are, quote, princes in the several tribes to which they belonged, heads of houses and families of their fathers, rulers of thousands, hundreds, etc. So in other words, this rebellion went much further than one family in the tribe of Levi and some members of the tribe of Reuben. They were members of all tribes represented. So this is a serious division. Now we know why, or we can speculate reasonably, why the Reubenites rebelled because of their lack of status, no birthright, and why the Kohathites fell because verse 10 says that they wanted to be priests. Why the disaffection amongst all the other tribes? Well, here's some speculations on that. It could be that Moses had given the priesthood to his relatives alone, the family of Aaron, and that might have ticked everybody else off. Why is Moses favoring people? He also favored the Kohathites with the privilege of carrying the holy objects of the tabernacle. And that's Moses' family. Aaron wasn't. Moses wasn't in Aaron's family, but he was in Kohath's family, and they had privileges too, carrying the holy objects. They were set apart as favored in Israel, and jealousy, jealousy, jealousy. Could be that the Israelites were accusing Moses of being a nepotist, favoring his own family. We don't know. It's good speculation, though. But whatever reason, or it could be they're just upset because they're in the wilderness and they want to go back to Egypt where it's safe and secure. Now, the rebels in verse 3 says, Moses, you've gone far enough. They were complaining that Moses was both a prophet and a civil ruler. In other words, he had spiritual authority and civil authority, and he had overstepped his bounds. But they were dead wrong about Moses overstepping his bounds, because in Hebrews 3:2, we read this, he was faithful to him. God was faithful to Jesus who appointed Jesus. Jesus was faithful to God who appointed Jesus, as Moses also was in all his house. So the book of Hebrews says that Moses was faithful in all of his house. That's the house of Israel. So these rebels were rebelling against truth, reason, and God. The King James translates it this. Instead of saying, you've gone far enough, they translate it this way. Ye take too much upon you. Nice Elizabethan English there. You take too much upon you. In other words, you're taking too many holy offices into your hands. Now then the rebels try to say, look, why do we have special people like the Levites and the Aaronic priest leading in Israel? Everybody's holy. We're all the same. Ah, there's an egalitarian for you. You know, we're all equal. We can all do the job the same as everybody else. There shouldn't be any honor or respect among certain people because that's not equal. That's not fair. Sounds like every socialist leftist you ever heard in your life. That's what they constantly say. It's just not fair because they don't believe in distinctions among human beings. Distinctions among human beings are natural. And in this case, they're created by God because God wanted to give certain honor to certain people. And that's just the way it is, folks. Now, why would the rebels think that the Israelites, everyone was holy? Well, John Gill speculates it's because they all heard the words of God on Mount Sinai. You remember the lightning and the thunder and the words of God. And the people said, oh, no, talk to Moses. Don't talk to us. You might kill us. But anyway, they experienced all that. And so they could say, well, we're just as holy as the Levites and as the Aaronites because of what we were at Mount Sinai. Of course, they don't mention the fact that they ended up setting up a golden calf and getting a lot of people killed as a result of God's judgment. No, they don't mention that. Now, it is true that God had said to the Israelites in Exodus 19:6, you shall be to me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. And you could infer from that that all the Israelites were holy and everybody should be a priest. But that's not what it means. That passage means you shall be to me a kingdom containing priest, a kingdom of priests, a kingdom containing priest. Doesn't mean that every son of Israel was going to be a priest like in the New Testament. Now the rebels continue with their speech to Moses and Aaron, and they said, the Lord is in the people's midst. Well, that's a little presumptuous. Unless you want to take it this way, the Lord is in the people's midst because he's living in the tabernacle, and the tabernacle is camped in the middle of the people, as the camp was laid out around the tabernacle. So technically they were right, but only technically. As far as God being in favor of them, no, God was opposed to them. We go now to verses 4 through 7, number 16. When Moses heard this, he fell on his face, and he spoke to Korah and all his company, saying, tomorrow morning the Lord will show who is his and who is holy, and will bring him near to himself. Even the one whom he will choose, he will bring near to himself. Do this, take censers for yourselves, Korah and all your company, and put fire in them, and lay incense upon them in the presence of the Lord tomorrow. And the man whom the Lord chooses shall be the one who is holy. You have gone far enough, you sons of Levi. Now this is a contest for the high priesthood here between Aaron and Korah. And Moses took up the challenge when they got in his face. He got back in Korah and his company's face. In verse 4 it says, when Moses heard this, he fell on his face. Now John Gill speculates as to why Moses is falling on his face. Could it be shame? I can't believe you're doing this. Oh, I can't even look at you falling on your face. Well, maybe fear of divine displeasure. He's falling on his face because he's expecting lightning to strike from above. It's another good speculation. Now, here's one I don't agree with. Was he falling on his face to pray for the rebels' pardon and forgiveness? Oh, I'm so sorry. No, Moses was not a wuss. He was not somebody who was confronted by cancel culture. God said, I'm so sorry. I'm going to learn from my mistakes. He didn't do that. Was he falling on his face to pray to God that he would be vindicated against the false charge? Now, I think that's what it is. He's falling on his face to praying to God. Help me. And then he spoke to Korah. Now, why did Moses speak to Korah and to nobody else in the rebellion? Apparently, Korah was the ringleader for one thing. He was also Moses' cousin. Maybe Moses figured he could have more influence with his cousin. Also, Korah was a Levite. The other three were Reubenites. And the other leaders, of course, were different tribal members. But Korah was a special guy. He was a Levite and ostensibly had more grievances. He could more easily make a claim for the priesthood than the Reubenites. And so there was a greater need to mollify him. Remember, this is going to be a contest for the high priesthood, between Aaron and Korah. Now, Moses set up this contest for the next morning. The normal time for judicial decisions in the East was in the morning. Interesting cultural comment. But John Gill also points out that the postponement of the contest till the morning gave the rebels a chance to reflect upon their sin. They had a chance to think, do we really want to go through with this? They should have thought more deeply than they did. Now in verse 6, Moses says, take censers for yourselves and put fire in them, lay incense on them. Why? What's the point of the censers? Well, that's because priests did censers, and this was a contest for the high priesthood. So it would make sense that the contestants for that high priesthood would be carrying censers with coals of fire in there and incense laid on the fire. And the idea is, we're going to offer this incense to God. If God accepts the incense, well, then that person's the high priest. If he doesn't accept the incense, and we'll see later how he is going to judge the rebellion, if he shows his displeasure at the person who is offering the incense, then we'll know who wins this contest and who's supposed to be the high priest. Now, verse 6 mentions Korah and his company. Of course, that's the 250 leaders of Israel that came with Korah. Verse 7 says, which shows that that all 250 had censers, not just Korah, as well as the Reubenites, I'm sure. Moses tells them to show up in the morning in the presence of the Lord. Where's the presence of the Lord? That's at the doorway of the tent of meeting, the doorway of the tabernacle, because God's in the Holy of Holies there in the tabernacle. So that's where they're going to have this contest, in the courtyard where everybody can see it. Now, in verse 7, it says, the man whom the Lord chooses shall be the one who is holy. Not the whole congregation, but the one who chooses. And of course, we'll find out later how God showed his choice. And then Moses says, the man whom the Lord chooses shall be the one. Does not Moses know who the one is as Aaron? Yeah, he knew. He was just setting Korah up to get judged by God because he knew who the one was. He knew who God had chosen. Moses had spoken face to face with God. And how many times had God said, and the Lord said to Aaron and Moses, the Lord said to Aaron and Moses, or the Lord said to Moses, go tell Aaron. I mean, Moses knew who the high priest truly was. He knew what was going to happen. There was going to be some bad stuff going down for Korah and his company. And then Moses says, you have gone far enough, you sons of Levi. Sons of Levi sounds like a curse. You have gone far enough. Well, now Moses is getting up front with these rebels because that's exactly, he's trolling them. He's mocking them. That's exactly what they had said to him. In a previous verse, verse 3, they had said to Moses, you have gone far enough. And now Moses gets right back in their face and says, no, Korah, you have gone far enough. I love it. Moses was not a wuss. He stood up for that which was right, true, just, and correct. He calls them the sons of Levi because he's still addressing the leaders of the rebellion. That would be the Kohathites. Korah was a Kohathite. And of course, Kohathite was a family of Levi, so that's why he calls them the sons of Levi. And he says, God will bring near the person that God wants to choose. Jameson Fawcett Brown says that's through some miraculous method of God's choosing, which we're going to see. Let me read verse 5. It says, tomorrow morning the Lord will show who he is and who is holy and will bring him near to himself, which is just a way of saying he's going to put the high priest under his right arm and show who's boss here. We go now to Numbers 16, verses 8 through 11. Then Moses said to Korah, hear now, you sons of Levi, is it not enough for you that the God of Israel has separated you from the rest of the congregation of Israel to bring you near to himself, to do the service of the tabernacle of the Lord, and to stand before the congregation to minister to them? And he has brought you near, Korah, and all your brothers, sons of Levi, with you. And are you seeking for the priesthood also? Therefore, you and all your company are gathered together against the Lord. But as for Aaron, who is he that you grumble against him? As I just said, Moses knew who God's Holy One was. It's Aaron, not Korah. So Moses is saying, look, you Levites, what are you complaining about? God's already separated you from the rest of the congregation, given you honor, placed you near the temple so that you can do the service. to do the service of the tabernacle. What would the service be? Well, some of the duties would be to watch and guard the tabernacle, to take the tabernacle down, set it up, carry the holy vessels inside the tabernacle, to sing songs for the tabernacle, to sacrifice animals, to cook animals, deliver them to the priest, and all of that. You're special already, and now you're complaining because you got to have more. God's already brought you near. That means he took you into the courts of the tabernacle. Didn't put you in the tabernacle itself, but you're in the court. That's near. That's near to the presence of God, but you're still complaining because you didn't get the priesthood. And isn't that so human, isn't that? It doesn't matter how high we climb in our corporation. Oh, I wish I was a little bit higher. Or how we climb in politics. Oh, I wish I was a little higher. Or in the academy. Oh, I wish I had a higher academic degree or a position. It goes on and on and on. Human beings are climbers. They're not content with the way God, with where we are. Now look at the Apostle Paul, penniless, a wanderer, a sojourner, a cast-off. And yet he said he had all things. He was blessed with all things. God had supplied all his needs. He wasn't worried about all that. But no, Korah exhibits an opposite spirit. We go now to Number 16, verses 12 through 14. Then Moses sent a summons to Dathan and Abiram, the sons of Eliab, but they said, "We will not come up. Is it not enough that you have brought us up out of a land flowing with milk and honey to have us die in the wilderness, but you would also lord it over us? Indeed, you have not brought us into a land flowing with milk and honey, nor have you given us an inheritance of fields and vineyards. Would you put out the eyes of these men? We will not come up." Well, that's bold talk. I suspect they were scared. I think they were cowards, but I don't know. Jameson, Foss, and Brown said they weren't really cowardly here. They were complaining about Moses' civil jurisdiction. They're saying, "Moses, you ain't got the right to tell anybody to come up. You don't even have jurisdiction over this dispute." And Korah, even he is going to come up. He is acknowledging implicitly Moses' rulership over the sons of Israel by doing that. But we're not going to even do that. We're not going to even let Moses have the honor of our presence. So Dathan and Abiram are complaining about Moses' civil jurisdiction. As Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown say, Korah was complaining about Moses' priestly jurisdiction. So Moses is getting hit on the civil and religious fronts here. Dathan and Abiram say they're not going to come up to where? The tabernacle, Moses' personal family tent, maybe the courtyard. Doesn't matter. I think it's the courtyard in front of the tabernacle is what is being referred to here. Now they say that Moses has taken them, from a land of milk and honey, Egypt. Well, that's delusional. How stupid can you be? They were slaves in Egypt. As the NIV Study Bible says, Egypt was a prison for the slaves of Israel, not a paradise. Now in verse 13, Dathan and Abiram say that Moses is trying to kill them. "Is it not enough that you've brought us out of a land flowing with milk and honey to have us die in the wilderness?" Maybe not intentionally murder them, but at least negligently kill the Israelites. Well, that's a serious charge. It's probably a reference to Moses' earlier announcement that all over 20 would die in the wilderness. Remember, we talked about that a couple chapters ago. Because of the listening to the spies' bad report, God says, "Okay, you're not going to enter in unless you're under 20. But if you were a numbered man in the census, you're going to die in the wilderness." And so that's probably what they're referring to. Dathan and Abiram said, "We're going to die in the wilderness." Now, Dathan and Abiram conveniently forgot that the people who are going to die in the wilderness is not from the lack of food that Moses has failed to provide them. I mean, have they forgotten the manna and the quails? No, they died in the wilderness because of their sinful disobedience. That wasn't Moses' fault. He didn't disobey God by listening to the spies' bad report. The people did. So these people are full of it, Dathan and Abiram. Now, they had a plausible pretext, an ostensible pretext to complain and rebel on the surface, complaining that Moses was leading them around like blind men in the desert in order to die, because they were actually wandering around in the desert. But like I said, that wasn't Moses' fault. Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown says that apparently Dathan and Abiram were thinking that Moses had some secret and selfish purpose for marching them into the desert to die. Well, what would that be? This is utterly foolishness. Now in verse 14, Dathan and Abiram say, "Would you put out the eyes of these men?" In other words, the 250 rulers and the Korathites and Dathan and Abiram and all of them, the company of Korah. "Would you put out their eyes?" What does he mean by Moses? Are you going to put out their eyes? Here's some options. First option, Jogdeel. Dathan and Abiram's eyes were metaphorically blinded. And I guess it would refer to the others, 250 besides Dathan and Abiram. That's option number one. Would you put out their eyes so that they would be blind and not be able to see their way back to Egypt? Or it could be the eyes of the whole congregation, not just Dathan and Abiram. It depends on who the these are. Put out these eyes. Or it could be the elders that were with Moses. Will you put out these elders' eyes that are blinded by delusion, these 250 elders? So basically the question is who these men are. Put out the eyes means to blind them so they can't see where they're going. Now, there is a textual problem here. The NIV noticed other textual possibilities. One is this. Would you make slaves of these men? Well, that's reasonable. Would you make a slave out of these men? You dictator Moses, you slave driver Moses, or would you deceive these men? Another textual option, would you deceive these men? Well, difference between put out the eyes and make them blind and make them deceived is pretty close. We go down to Numbers 16:15. Then Moses became very angry and said to the Lord, "Do not regard their offering. I have not taken a single donkey from them, nor have I done harm to any of them." Now, I asked myself the question, was Moses sinning here when he got angry? I don't think so. Jesus got angry at the money changers in the temple. He turned their tables over. He was angry. Did Jesus sin? Of course not. I don't think Moses' anger was a sin. He had reason to be angry. As long as he let his anger go down, stop at sunset, he's probably okay, according to that famous scripture. Moses says to God, "Do not regard their offering." Well, there was never any danger of that. God wasn't going to honor the offering of these crazy people. I asked myself another question. I wonder, did Moses think that perhaps God would honor the rebels' offering? Was he a little bit in doubt about the outcome? I don't think so. But he might have been praying just to be sure. You know, the future is unpredictable. We go down to Numbers 16, verses 16 through 21. Moses said to Korah, "You and all your company be present before the Lord tomorrow, both you and they along with Aaron," in other words, you, Korah, and the company, the 250 leaders plus Dathan and Abiram, "and come along, and Aaron's going to be here too. Each of you take his fire pan and put incense on it, and each of you bring his censer before the Lord, 250 fire pans. Also you and Aaron shall each bring his fire pan." So they each took his own censer and put fire on it and laid incense on it, and they stood at the doorway of the tent of meeting with Moses and Aaron. Thus Korah assembled all the congregation against them at the doorway of the tent of meeting. That's against Moses and Aaron, against them. And the glory of the Lord appeared to all the congregation. That's the Shekinah glory in the Holy of Holies, also on top of the tabernacle most probably, and he probably flashed. Then the Lord spoke to Moses and Aaron, saying, "Separate yourselves from among this congregation that I may consume them instantly." So much for the contest. He just said, we're not even going to play this game. I'm just going to burn them up. Now, let's set the stage here a little bit. In verse 16, Moses said to Korah, remember, Dathan and Abiram aren't there. They refused to come up. They had left, most probably. Well, not most probably, actually, because verse 12 says Moses sent a summons to them to come up, and they refused to come. So that's why they're not here. That's why it's only Korah who is being talked to here. Dathan and Abiram were thus excluded from the invitation to appear before the tabernacle. Jogdeel has a little discussion on what these fire pans are, vessels used in family worship before the sanctuary was set up. Maybe cooking dishes which could be used as censers. I guess what he's saying is that 250 is a lot of censers, so they had to come up with something to substitute for censers. Another option is small platters common in Egyptian families which were used to offer incense, which would be part of the plunder of the Egyptians. Remember in Exodus 12, verses 35 and 36, the sons of Israel had requested from the Egyptians articles of silver and articles of gold, .. So that's probably where they got some censers. And, of course, the 250 fire pans, one for each of the 250 rebelling leaders. Now, these 250 leaders, having their censer with fire and incense on it, they stood at the doorway of the tent of meeting. Now, the doorway of the tent of meeting, that's right there in the courtyard. That's right where the bronze laver and the bronze altar are. A very prominent place. They stood there. It says in verse 18, one of my commentators says they stood in a bold and presumptuous manner as if they were equals with Moses. But at any rate, they're standing there in front of the doorway where everybody could see the result. Verse 19 says Korah assembled all the congregation against them at the doorway of the tent of meeting. Well, that's in the courtyard before the tabernacle. 2 million people can't stand there, of course, so that's talking about the leaders, all the leaders. It would refer to the 250 leaders of the congregation. I assume that's who it is. 250 could fit there. Some say the whole, every rebel that would follow these leaders also were gathered together in the courtyard. I'm not sure about that. But anyway, there's a company of rebels there standing at the doorway of the tent of meeting waiting to see what God's got to say about this. Now, the Shekinah glory appears, and the glory must have risen over the tabernacle. And I picture that as if the Shekinah glory resides in the Holy of Holies, that means he could just actually go through the ceiling, because after all, it is a cloud, and go through the ceiling. And he did. At any rate, he was there visible, and he spoke to Moses and Aaron, saying, "Get yourselves out from among this congregation," meaning the company of rebels. Jameson Fawcett Brown says it seems that Korah's rebellion had spread to the people, his congregation, but it could just be the group of leaders, I don't know. But the rebellion had spread, and God says, "Moses and Aaron, I think you better get out of here. It's going to be some judgment coming on." Numbers 16, verse 22, "But they," that's Moses and Aaron, "fell on their faces and said, 'O God, God of the spirits of all flesh, when one man sins, will you be angry with the entire congregation?'" Now, boy, that's some grace there. These people needed to get wiped out, and Moses is praying that God would spare them. And Aaron prayed that way, too. They were interceding for their enemies. They were very merciful, as the NIV Study Bible notes, and the Jameson Fawcett Brown says they were interceding for their enemies. Well, I think about that. They weren't exactly Moses and Aaron weren't exactly interceding for Korah and Dathan and Abiram. They were really praying for the congregation at large. Remember, Moses is constantly worried about the whole congregation getting wiped out and making God look bad in the eyes of the Egyptian. Remember the golden calf incident and the incident of the bad report from the spies? No, God, please don't wipe them out. And I think that's what he's saying here, because he says the entire congregation. You're going to be mad at the entire congregation? Moses' plea for the congregation, one man for the whole bunch, he's saying, hey, one man's sin, you're going to wipe everybody out. Doesn't that sound like what Abraham did when he was pleading for the inhabitants of Sodom? Genesis 18:25, "Far be it from you, God, to do such a thing, to slay the righteous with the wicked, so that the righteous and the wicked are treated alike. Far be it from you. Shall not the judge of all the earth deal justly?" Pretty cheeky there, Abraham, telling God how to be just. The idea is, hey, only Korah sinned, and so why are you going to wipe everybody out? But it seems to me that God was only going to wipe out the rebels, not the entire congregation. So maybe Moses and Aaron were being just a little bit overwrought here. I don't think God was angry with the entire congregation. I think he was angry with the entire group of rebels, that congregation, if you will. Now, Moses and Aaron address God as the God of the spirits of all flesh. Now, that word spirits proves that these Old Testament men believed that man was composed of both flesh and spirit. There was no belief in the materiality of the human soul, as Adam Clark points out. Now, that word spirits of flesh we see in other places in the Scripture. For example, in Numbers 27:16, "May the Lord, the God of the spirits of all flesh," Job 12:10, "in whose hand is the life of every living thing and the spirit of all mankind." Now, spirit there could be translated as breath, so that makes that Job 12 a little bit ambiguous, but not here. In our verses and Numbers, the God of the spirits of all flesh, you don't say the God of the breath of all flesh. So that's kind of interesting. Moses is not thinking about man having a spirit, but he instinctively prays to the God of the spirits of all flesh. We are not mere matter. Atheist materialist. Of course, the one man, the sin of one man, Moses is narrowing it down to Korah. It was actually more than that. And see, that was a little bit of a misstatement of the problem here that Moses and Aaron are making to God. They say when one man sins, it was more than one man. It was Dathan and Abiram and the 250 leaders of the rebels of the other tribes and whoever went along with those leaders. So it was more than just one man. So Moses is putting his best face on it. I guess that's his job. All right, let's look at verses 23 and 24. We'll finish up this audio. "Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, 'Speak to the congregation, saying, get back from around the dwellings of Korah, Dathan, and Abiram.'" Something bad's about to go down here. Now, if you look at the camp of the Israelites, remember that the Kohathites, of which family Korah belonged, or to which family Korah belonged, they were gathered together at the very southern edge of the tabernacle. Now, if you look at the Reubenites, as I pointed out earlier, they are at the southeast of the tabernacle, catty corner to the Kohathites. So they were in close communion. So it's easy here for God to judge those particular dwelling places without wiping out the rest of the congregation. Now, one little comment about verse 24 about Korah, as we anticipate the judgment that's about to fall on them. Basically, it was earthquake and fire, and Korah had apparently left the company of the 250 false priests as they were gathered around the doorway of the tent of meeting. Apparently, he was standing with Dathan and Abiram because the other 250 priests were burnt up, whereas later Korah was swallowed up in an earthquake. And with that little preview, that'll prepare us for the last half of number 16, verses 25 through 50, in which passage we will discuss the end of Korah's Rebellion, or Korah's Rebellion Part 2. I hope you stay tuned for that, and I hope you enjoyed this audio.